Chapter 25. That to know God is the end of every intelligent substance. Now, seeing that all creatures, even those that are devoid of reason, are directed to God as their last end and that all reach this end in so far as they have some share of a likeness to Him, the intellectual creature attains to Him in a special way, namely through its proper operation, by understanding Him. Consequently, this must be the end of the intelligent creature, namely to understand God, for, as we have shown above, God is the end of each thing, wherefore as far as it is possible to it, each thing intends to be united to God as its last end. Now a thing is more closely united to God by reaching in a way to the very substance of God, which happens when it knows something of the divine substance, than when it reaches to a divine likeness. Therefore the intellectual substance tends to the knowledge of God as its last end. Again, the operation proper to a thing is the end thereof, for it is its second perfection, so that when a thing is well conditioned for its proper operation it is said to be efficient and good. Now understanding is the proper operation of the intellectual substance and consequently it is its end. Therefore whatever is most perfect in this operation is its last end, especially in those operations which are not directed to some product, such as understanding and sensation. And since operations of this kind take their species from their objects, by which also they are known, it follows that the more perfect the object of any such operation, the more perfect is the operation. Consequently, to understand the most perfect intelligible, namely God, is the most perfect in the genus of this operation which is to understand. Therefore to know God by an act of intelligence is the last end of every intellectual substance. Someone, however, might say that the last end of an intellectual substance consists indeed in understanding the best intelligible, but that what is the best intelligible for this or that intellectual substance is not simply the best intelligible, and that the higher the intellectual substance, the higher is its best intelligible, so that possibly the supreme intellectual substance has for its best intelligible that which is best simply, and its happiness will consist in understanding God, whereas the happiness of any lower intellectual substance will consist in understanding some lower intelligible, which however will be the highest thing understood by that substance. Especially would it seem not to be in the power of the human intellect to understand that which is simply the best intelligible, on account of its weakness, for it is as much adapted for knowing the supreme intelligible as the owl's eye for seeing the sun. Nevertheless, it is evident that the end of any intellectual substance, even the lowest, is to understand God. For it has been shown above that God is the last end towards which all things tend, and the human intellect, although the lowest in the order of intelligent substances, is superior to all that are devoid of understanding. Since then a more exalted substance has not a less exalted end, God will be the end also of the human intelligence. Now every intelligent being attains to its last end by understanding it, as we have proved. Therefore the human intellect attains to God as its end, by understanding Him. Again, just as things devoid of intelligence tend to God as their end, by way of assimilation, so do intelligent substances by way of knowledge, as clearly appears from what has been said. Now although things devoid of reason tend towards a likeness to their proximate causes, the intention of nature does not rest there, but has for its end a likeness to the sovereign good. As we have proved, although they are able to attain to this likeness in a most imperfect manner, therefore however little be the knowledge of God to which the intellect is able to attain, this will be the intellect's last end, rather than the perfect knowledge of lower intelligibles. Moreover, everything desires its last end most of all. Now the human intellect desires, loves and enjoys the knowledge of divine things, although it can grasp but little about them, more than the perfect knowledge which it has of the lower world. Therefore man's last end is to understand God in some way or other. Further, everything tends to a divine likeness as its own end. Therefore a thing's last end is that whereby it is most of all like unto God. Now the intellectual creature is especially like unto God in that it is intellectual, since this likeness belongs to it above other creatures, and includes all other likenesses. And in this particular kind of likeness, it is more like God in understanding actually than in understanding habitually or potentially, because God is always actually understanding, as we proved in the first book. In understanding actually, he is especially like God. In understanding God, because by understanding himself, God understands all other things, as we proved in the first book. Therefore, the last end of every intelligent substance is to understand God. Again, that which is lovable only on account of another, is for the sake of that which is lovable for its own sake alone, because we cannot go on indefinitely in the appetite of nature, since then nature's desire would be in vain. For it is impossible to pass through an infinite number of things. Now all practical sciences, arts and powers are lovable only for the sake of something else, since their end is not knowledge, but work. But speculative sciences are lovable for their own sake, for their end is knowledge itself. Nor can we find any action in connection with man, that is not directed to some other end, with the exception of speculative consideration. For even playful actions, which would seem to be done without any purpose, have some end due to them, namely that the mind may be relaxed, and that thereby we may afterwards become more fit for studious occupations, else we should always have to be playing, if play were desirable for its own sake, and this is unreasonable. Accordingly, practical art is directed to speculative art, and again every human operation, to intellectual speculation, as its end. Now, in all sciences and arts that are mutually subordinate, the last end apparently belongs to the one from which others take their rules and principles. Thus the art of sailing, to which belongs the ship's end, namely its use, provides rules and principles to the art of shipbuilding. And such is the relation of metaphysics to other speculative sciences, for all others depend thereon, since they derive their principles from it, and are directed by it in defending those principles. Moreover, metaphysics is wholly directed to God as its last end, wherefore it is called the divine science. Therefore, the knowledge of God is the last end of all human knowledge and actions. Furthermore, in all mutually subordinate agents and movers, the end of the first agent must be the end of all, even as the end of the commander in chief is the end of all who are soldiering under him. Now of all the parts of man, the intellect is the highest mover, for it moves the appetite, by proposing its object to it, and the intellective appetite or will, moves the sensitive appetites, namely the irascible and concupiscible, so that we do not obey the concupiscence, unless the will command. And the sensitive appetite, the will consenting, moves the body. Therefore the end of the intellect is the end of all human actions. Now the intellect's end and good are the true, and its last end is the first truth. Therefore the last end of all man and of all his deeds and desires, is to know the first truth, namely God. Moreover, man has a natural desire to know the causes of whatever he sees, wherefore through wondering at what they saw, and ignoring its cause, men first began to philosophize, and when they had discovered the cause they were at rest. Nor do they cease inquiring until they come to the first cause, and then do we deem ourselves to know perfectly when we know the first cause. Therefore man naturally desires, as his last end, to know the first cause. But God is the first cause of all. Therefore man's last end is to know God. Besides, man naturally desires to know the cause of any known effect. Now the human intellect knows universal being. Therefore it naturally desires to know its cause, which is God alone, as we proved in the second book. Now one has not attained to one's last end until the natural desire is at rest. Therefore the knowledge of any intelligible object is not enough for man's happiness, which is his last end, unless he know God also, which knowledge terminates his natural desire, as his last end. Therefore this very knowledge of God is man's last end. Further, a body that tends by its natural appetite to its place, is moved all the more vehemently and rapidly, the nearer it approaches its end. Wherefore Aristotle proves Article 8, that a natural straight movement cannot be towards an indefinite point, because it would not be more moved afterwards than before. Hence that which tends more vehemently to a thing afterwards than before, is not moved towards an indefinite point but towards something fixed. Now this we find in the desire of knowledge, for the more one knows, the greater one's desire to know. Consequently, man's natural desire in knowledge tends to a definite end. This can be no other but the highest thing knowable, which is God. Therefore, the knowledge of God is man's last end. Now, the last end of man and of any intelligent substance is called happiness or beatitude, for it is this that every intelligent substance desires as its last end, and for its own sake alone. Therefore, the last beatitude or happiness of any intelligent substance is to know God. Hence it is said, "Blessed are the clean of heart, for they shall see God," and this is eternal life, that they may know thee, the only true God. Aristotle agrees with this statement when he says that man's ultimate happiness is contemplative, in regard to his contemplating the highest object of contemplation. Chapter 26. Does happiness consist in an act of the will? Since the intellectual substance attains to God by its operation, not only by an act of understanding but also by an act of the will, through desiring and loving Him, and through delighting in Him, someone might think that man's last end and ultimate happiness consists, not in knowing but in loving God or in some other act of the will towards Him, especially seeing that the object of the will is the good, which is the aspect of an end, whereas the true, which is the object of the intellect, has not the aspect of an end except for as much as it also is a good. Wherefore seemingly man does not attain to his last end by an act of his intellect, but rather by an act of his will. Further, the ultimate perfection of operation is delight, which perfects operation as beauty perfects youth, as the philosopher says. Hence, if the last end be a perfect operation, it would seem that it must consist in an act of the will rather than of the intellect. Again, delight apparently is desired for its own sake, so that it is never desired for the sake of something else, for it is silly to ask of anyone why he seeks to be delighted. Now this is a condition of the ultimate end, namely that it be sought for its own sake. Therefore seemingly the last end consists in an act of the will rather than of the intellect. Moreover, all agree in their desire for the last end, for it is a natural desire. Now more people seek delight than knowledge. Therefore delight would seem to be the last end rather than knowledge. Furthermore, the will is seemingly a higher power than the intellect, for the will moves the intellect to its act, since when a person wills, his intellect considers by an act what he holds by a habit. Wherefore seemingly the act of the will is higher than the act of the intellect. Therefore it would seem that the last end, which is beatitude, consists in an act of the will rather than of the intellect. But this can be clearly shown to be impossible. For since happiness is the proper good of the intellectual nature, it must needs become the intellectual nature according to that which is proper thereto. Now appetite is not proper to the intellectual nature, but is in all things, although it is different in different things. This difference, however, arises from things having a different relation to knowledge. For things wholly devoid of knowledge have only a natural appetite. Those that have a sensitive knowledge have also a sensitive appetite, under which the irascible and concupiscible appetites are comprised. And those which have intellective knowledge have also an appetite proportionate to that knowledge, namely the will. The will, therefore, forasmuch as it is an appetite, is not proper to the intellectual nature, but only in so far as it is dependent on the intellect. On the other hand, the intellect is in itself proper to the intellectual nature. Therefore beatitude or happiness consists principally and essentially in an act of the intellect, rather than in an act of the will. Again, in all powers that are moved by their objects, the object is naturally prior to the acts of those powers, even as the mover is naturally prior to the movable being moved. Now such a power is the will, for the appetible object moves the appetite. Therefore the will's object is naturally prior to its act, and consequently its first object precedes its every act. Therefore an act of the will cannot be the first thing willed. But this is the last end, which is beatitude. Therefore beatitude or happiness cannot be the very act of the will. Besides, in all those powers which are able to reflect on their act must first bear on some other object, and afterwards the power is brought to bear on its own act. For if the intellect understand that it understands, We must suppose first that it understands some particular thing, and that afterwards it understands that it understands, for this very act of intelligence which the intellect understands, must have an object. Hence either we must go on forever, or if we come to some first thing understood, this will not be an act of understanding, but some intelligible thing. In the same way the first thing willed cannot be the very act of willing, but must be some other good. Now the first thing willed by an intelligent nature, is beatitude or happiness, because for its sake we will whatever we will. Therefore happiness cannot consist in an act of the will. Further, the truth of a thing's nature is derived from those things which constitute its essence, for a true man differs from a man in a picture, by the things which constitute man's essence. Now false happiness does not differ from true in an act of the will, because whatever be proposed to the will as the supreme good, whether truly or falsely, it makes no difference to the will. Desiring, loving, or enjoying that good, the difference is on the part of the intellect, as to whether the good proposed as supreme be truly so or not. Therefore beatitude or happiness consists essentially in an act of the intellect rather than of the will. Again, if an act of the will were happiness itself, this act would be either desire, or love, or joy. But desire cannot possibly be the last end, for desire implies that the will is tending to what it has not yet, and this is contrary to the very notion of the last end. Nor can love be the last end, for a good is loved not only while it is in our possession, but even when it is not, because it is through love that we seek by desire what we have not. And if love of a thing we possess is more perfect, this arises from the fact that we possess the good we love. It is one thing, therefore, to possess the good which is our end, and another to love it, which love before we possessed was imperfect, and perfect after we obtained possession. Nor again is delight the last end, for it is possession of the good that causes delight, whether we are conscious of possessing it actually, or call to mind our previous possession, or hope to possess it in the future. Therefore delight is not the last end. Therefore no act of the will can be happiness itself essentially. Furthermore, if delight were the last end, it would be desirable for its own sake. But this is not true, because the desirability of a delight depends on what gives rise to the delight, since that which arises from good and desirable operations, is itself good and desirable, but that which arises from evil operations, is itself evil and to be avoided. Therefore its goodness and desirability are from something else, and consequently it is not itself the last end or happiness. Moreover, the right order of things agrees with the order of nature, for in the natural order things are directed to their end without any error. Now, in the natural order delight is on account of operation and not conversely. For it is to be observed that nature has joined delight with those animal operations which are clearly directed to necessary ends, for instance to the use of food that is directed to the preservation of the individual, and to sexual matters that are appointed for the preservation of the species, since were there no pleasure, animals would abstain from the use of these necessary things. Therefore delight cannot be the last end. Again, delight, seemingly, is nothing else than the quiescence of the will in some becoming good, just as desire is the inclining of the will towards the attaining of some good. Now just as by his will, a man is inclined towards an end, and rests in it, so too have natural bodies a natural inclination to their respective ends, and are at rest when they have once attained their end. Now it is absurd to say that the end of the movement of a heavy body is not to be in its proper place, but that it is the quiescence of the inclination towards that place. For if it were nature's chief intent that this inclination should be quiescent, it would not give such an inclination, but it gives it so that the body may tend towards its place, and when it has arrived there, as though it were its end, quiescence of the inclination follows. Hence this quiescence is not the end, but accompanies the end. Neither therefore is delight the ultimate end, but accompanies it. Much less therefore is happiness any act of the will. Besides, if a thing have something extrinsic for its end, the operation whereby it first obtains that thing will be called its last end. Thus for those whose end is money, possession is said to be their end. but not love or desire. Now the last end of the intellective substance is God. Hence that operation of man whereby he first obtains God is essentially his happiness or beatitude. And this is understanding, since we cannot will what we do not understand. Therefore man's ultimate happiness is essentially to know God by the intellect, and not an act of the will. From what has been said, we can now solve the arguments that were objected in the contrary sense, for it does not necessarily follow that happiness is essentially the very act of the will. From the fact that it is the object of the will, through being the highest good, as the first argument reasoned, on the contrary, the fact that it is the first object of the will, shows that it is not an act of the will, as appears from what we have said. Nor does it follow that whatever perfects a thing in any way whatever, must be the end of that thing, as the second objection argued. For a thing perfects another in two ways. First, it perfects a thing that has its species. Secondly, it perfects a thing that it may have its species. Thus the perfection of a house considered as already having its species, is that to which the species house is directed, namely to be a dwelling, for one would not build a house but for that, and consequently we must include this in the definition of a house, if the definition is to be perfect. On the other hand, the perfection that conduces to the species of a house, is both that which is directed to the completion of the species, for instance its essential principles, and that which conduces to the preservation of the species, for instance the buttresses which are made to support the building, and those things which make the house more fit for use, for instance the symmetry of the building. Accordingly, that which is the perfection of a thing considered as already having its species, is its end, as the end of a house is to be a dwelling. Likewise, the operation proper to a thing, its use, as it were, is its end. On the other hand, whatever perfects a thing by conducing to its species, is not the end of that thing. In fact, the thing is its end. Thus matter and form are for the sake of the species. For although the form is the end of generation, it is not the end of the thing already generated and having its species, but is required in order that the species be complete. Again, things that preserve the thing in its species, such as health and the nutritive power, although they perfect the animal, are not the animal's end, but vice versa. And again, those things that adapt a thing for the perfection of its proper specific operations, and for the easier attainment of its proper end, are not the end of that thing, but vice versa. For instance, a man's comeliness and bodily strength, and the like, of which the philosopher says that they conduce to happiness instrumentally. Now delight is a perfection of operation, not as though operation were directed thereto in respect of its species, for thus it is directed to other ends. Thus eating, in respect of its species, is directed to the preservation of the individual, but it is like a perfection that is conducive to a thing's species, since for the sake of the delight we perform more attentively and becomingly an operation we delight in. Wherefore the philosopher says that delight perfects operation as beauty perfects youth, for beauty is for the sake of the one who has youth. Nor is the fact that men seek delight not for the sake of something else but for its own sake, a sufficient indication that delight is the last end, as the third objection argued. Because delight, though it is not the last end, nevertheless accompanies the last end, since delight arises from the attainment of the end. Nor do more people seek the pleasure that comes from knowledge than knowledge itself, but more there are who seek sensible delights than intellectual knowledge and the delight consequent thereto, because those things that are without are better known to the majority, in that human knowledge takes its beginning from sensible objects. The suggestion put forward by the fifth argument, that the will is a higher power than the intellect, as being the latter's motive force, is clearly untrue, because the intellect moves the will, first and per se, for the will, as such, is moved by its object, which is the apprehended good, whereas the will moves the intellect accidentally, as it were, in so far, to wit, that the act of intelligence is itself apprehended as a good, and on that account is desired by the will, the result being that the intellect understands actually. Even in this, the intellect precedes the will, for the will would never seek the act of intelligence, did not the intellect first apprehend its act of intelligence as a good. And again, The will moves the intellect to actual operation, in the same way as an agent is set to move, whereas the intellect moves the will in the same way as the end moves, for the good understood is the end of the will. Now the agent in moving comes after the end, for the agent does not move except on account of the end. It is therefore clear that the intellect is simply higher than the will, while the will is higher than the intellect accidentally and in a restricted sense. Chapter 27. That human happiness does not consist in carnal pleasures. From what has been said, it is clearly impossible that human happiness consist in pleasures of the body, the chief of which are pleasures of the table and of sex. It has been shown that according to nature's order, pleasure is on account of operation, and not conversely. Wherefore, if an operation be not the ultimate end, the consequent pleasure can neither be the ultimate end, nor accompany the ultimate end. Now it is manifest that the operations which are followed by the pleasures mentioned above are not the last end, for they are directed to certain manifest ends, eating, for instance, to the preservation of the body, and carnal intercourse to the begetting of children. Therefore the aforesaid pleasures are not the last end, nor do they accompany the last end. Therefore happiness does not consist in them. Again, the will is higher than the sensitive appetite, for it moves it, as stated above. But happiness does not consist in an act of the will, as we have already proved. Much less therefore does it consist in the aforesaid pleasures which are seated in the sensitive appetite. Moreover, happiness is a good proper to man, for it is an abuse of terms to speak of dumb animals as being happy. Now these pleasures are common to man and beast. Therefore we must not assign happiness to them. Besides, the highest perfection of man cannot consist in his being united to things lower than himself, but consists in his being united to something above him, for the end is better than that which tends to the end. Now these pleasures consist in man being united through his senses to things beneath him, namely certain sensible objects. Therefore we must not assign happiness to such like pleasures. Further, that which is not good unless it be moderate, is not good in itself, but receives its goodness from its moderator. Now the use of the aforesaid pleasures is not good for man unless it be moderate, for otherwise they would frustrate one another. Therefore these pleasures are not in themselves man's good, but the sovereign good is good essentially, because that which is good of itself is better than what is good through another. Therefore such like pleasures are not man's supreme good, which is happiness. Again, in all per se predications, if a be predicated of B simply, an increase in a will be predicated of an increase in B. Thus if a hot thing heats, a hotter thing heats more, and the hottest thing heats most. Accordingly if the pleasures in question were good in themselves, it would follow that to use them very much is very good. But this is clearly false, because it is considered sinful to use them too much. Besides, it is hurtful to the body, and hinders pleasures of the same kind. Therefore they are not per se man's good, and human happiness does not consist in them. Again, acts of virtue are praiseworthy through being directed to happiness. If therefore human happiness consisted in the aforesaid pleasures, an act of virtue would be more praiseworthy in acceding to them than in abstaining from them. But this is clearly untrue, for the act of temperance is especially praised in abstinence from pleasures, whence that act takes its name. Therefore man's happiness is not in these pleasures. Furthermore, the last end of everything is God, as was proved above. We must therefore posit as man's last end that by which especially man approaches to God. Now man is hindered by the aforesaid pleasures from his chief approach to God, which is effected by contemplation, to which these same pleasures are a very great hindrance, since more than anything they plunge man into the midst of sensible things, and consequently withdraw him from intelligible things. Therefore human happiness is not to be placed in bodily pleasures. Hereby is refuted the error of the Epicureans, who ascribed man's happiness to pleasures of this kind in their person. Solomon says, "This therefore hath seemed good to me, that a man should eat and drink, and enjoy the fruit of his labor." And this is his portion, and let us everywhere leave tokens of joy, for this is our portion, and this is our lot. The error of the Cerinthians is also refuted, for they pretended that, in the state of final happiness, After the resurrection, Christ will reign for 1,000 years, and men will indulge in the carnal pleasures of the table, wherefore they are called Chiliasti, or believers in the millennium. The fables of the Jews and Mohammedans are also refuted, who pretend that the reward of the righteous consists in such like pleasures, for happiness is the reward of virtue. Chapter 28. That happiness does not consist in honors. From the foregoing it is also clear that neither does man's supreme good, or happiness, consist in honors, for man's ultimate end and happiness is his most perfect operation, as we have shown above. But man's honor does not consist in something done by him, but in something done to him by another who shows him honor. Therefore man's happiness must not be placed in honors. Again, that which is on account of another good and desirable thing is not the last end. Now such is honor, for a man is not rightly honored, except on account of some other good in him. For this reason do men seek to be honored, as though wishing to have a voucher for some good that is in them, so that they rejoice more in being honored by the great and the wise. Therefore we must not assign man's happiness to honors. Besides, happiness is obtained through virtue. Now virtuous deeds are voluntary, else they were not praiseworthy. Therefore happiness must be a good obtainable by man through his will. But it is not in a man's power to secure honor, rather is it in the power of the man who pays honor. Therefore happiness is not to be assigned to honors. Moreover, only the good can be worthy of honor, and yet it is possible even for the wicked to be honored. Therefore it is better to become worthy of honor than to be honored. Therefore honor is not man's supreme good. Furthermore, the supreme good is the perfect good. Now the perfect good is incompatible with any evil. But that which has no evil in it cannot possibly be evil. Therefore that which is in possession of the supreme good cannot be evil. Yet it is possible for an evil person to receive honor. Therefore honor is not man's supreme good. Chapter 29. That man's happiness consists not in glory. Wherefore it is evident also that man's supreme good does not consist in glory, which is the recognition of one's good name. For glory, according to Cicero, is the general recognition and praise of a person's good name, and in the words of Ambrose, in being well known and praised. Now men seek praise and distinction through being famous, so that they may be honored by those whom their fame reaches. Therefore glory is sought for the sake of honor, and consequently if honor be not the sovereign good, much less is glory. Again, those goods are worthy of praise whereby a man shows himself to be directed to his end. Now he who is directed to his end has not yet reached his last end. Therefore praise is not bestowed on one who has reached his last end, rather does he receive honor, as the philosopher says. Therefore glory cannot be the supreme good, since it consists chiefly in praise. Besides, it is better to know than to be known, because only the higher things know, whereas the lowest are known. Therefore man's supreme good cannot be glory, which consists in a man being known. Further, a man does not seek to be known except in good things, and in evil things he seeks to be hidden. Therefore to be known is good and desirable, on account of the good things that are known in a man. Therefore these good things are better still. Consequently glory, which consists in a man being known, is not his supreme good. Moreover, the supreme good must needs be perfect, for it satisfies the appetite. But the knowledge of one's good name, wherein glory consists, is imperfect, for it is beset with much uncertainty and error. Therefore glory of this kind cannot be the supreme good. Furthermore, man's supreme good must be supremely stable in human things, for it is natural to desire unfailing endurance in one's goods. Now glory, which consists in fame, is most unstable, since nothing is more changeable than human opinion and praise. Therefore such glory is not man's supreme good. Chapter 30. That man's happiness does not consist in wealth. Hence it is evident that neither is wealth man's supreme good, for wealth is not sought except for the sake of something else. Because of itself it brings us no good, but only when we use it, whether for the support of the body, or for some similar purpose. Now the supreme good is sought for its own, and not for another's sake. Therefore wealth is not man's supreme good. Again, man's supreme good cannot consist in the possession or preservation of things whose chief advantage for man consists in their being spent. Now the chief advantage of wealth is in its being spent, for this is its use. Therefore the possession of wealth cannot be man's supreme good. Moreover, acts of virtue deserve praise according as they lead to happiness. Now acts of liberality and magnificence which are concerned with money are deserving of praise, on account of money being spent, rather than on account of its being kept, and it is from this that these virtues derive their names. Therefore man's happiness does not consist in the possession of wealth. Besides, man's supreme good must consist in obtaining something better than man. But man is better than wealth, since it is something directed to man's use. Therefore not in wealth does man's supreme good consist. Further, man's supreme good is not subject to chance, for things that happen by chance escape the forethought of reason, whereas man has to attain his own end by means of his reason. But chance occupies the greater place in the attaining of wealth. Therefore human happiness consists not in wealth. Moreover, this is evident from the fact that wealth is lost unwillingly. Also because wealth can come into the possession of evil persons, who, of necessity, must lack the sovereign good. Again, because wealth is unstable. Other similar reasons can be gathered from the arguments given above. Chapter 31. That happiness consists not in worldly power. In like manner neither can worldly power be man's supreme happiness, since in the achievement thereof chance can effect much. Again, it is unstable, and is not subject to man's will, and is often obtained by evil men. These are incompatible with the supreme good, as already stated. Again, man is said to be good especially according as he approaches the supreme good, but in respect to his having power, he is not said to be either good or evil, since not everyone who can do good deeds is good, nor is a person evil because he can do evil deeds. Therefore the supreme good does not consist in being powerful. Besides, every power implies reference to something else. But the supreme good is not referred to anything further. Therefore power is not man's supreme good. Moreover, man's supreme good cannot be a thing that one can use both well and ill, for the better things are those that we cannot abuse. But one can use one's power both well and ill, for rational powers can be directed to contrary objects. Therefore human power is not man's supreme good. Further, if any power be man's supreme good, it must be most perfect. Now human power is most imperfect, for it is based on human will and opinion, which are full of inconsistencies. Also the greater a power is reputed to be, the greater number of people does it depend on, which again conduces to its weakness, since what depends on many is in many ways destructible. Therefore man's supreme good does not consist in worldly power. Consequently man's happiness consists in no external good, for all external goods, which are known as goods of chance, are contained under those we have mentioned. Chapter 32. That happiness consists not in goods of the body. Like arguments avail to prove that man's supreme good does not consist in goods of the body, such as health, beauty and strength, for they are common to good and evil and are unstable and are not subject to the will. Besides, the soul is better than the body, which neither lives nor possesses these goods, without the soul. Wherefore the soul's good, such as understanding and the like, is better than the body's good. Therefore the body's good is not man's supreme good. Again, these goods are common to man and other animals, whereas happiness is a good proper to man. Therefore man's happiness does not consist in the things mentioned. Moreover, many animals surpass man in goods of the body, for some are fleeter than he, some more sturdy, and so on. Accordingly, if man's supreme good consisted in these things, man would not excel all animals, which is clearly untrue. Therefore human happiness does not consist in goods of the body. Chapter 33. That human happiness is not seated in the senses. By the same arguments it is evident that neither does man's supreme good consist in goods of his sensitive faculty. For these goods again, are common to man and other animals. Again, intellect is superior to sense. Therefore, the intellect's good is better than the senses. Consequently, man's supreme good is not seated in the senses. Besides, the greatest sensual pleasures are those of the table and of sex, wherein the supreme good must needs be, if seated in the senses. But it does not consist in them. Man's supreme good is not in the senses. Moreover, the senses are appreciated for their utility and for knowledge. Now the entire utility of the senses is referred to the goods of the body. Again, sensitive knowledge is directed to intellective, wherefore animals devoid of intelligence take no pleasure in sensation except in reference to some bodily utility, insofar as by sensitive knowledge they obtain food or sexual intercourse. Therefore, man's supreme good, which is happiness, is not seated in the sensitive faculty. Chapter 34. That man's ultimate happiness does not consist in acts of moral virtue. It is clear that man's ultimate happiness does not consist in moral works. For human happiness, if ultimate, cannot be directed to a further end, but all moral deeds can be directed to something else. This is clear from a consideration of the principle among them. Because deeds of fortitude in time of war are directed to victory and peace, for it were foolish to go to war merely for its own sake. Again, deeds of justice are directed to keeping peace among men, through each one possessing his own in peace. The same applies to all other virtues. Therefore, man's ultimate happiness is not in moral deeds. Again, the purpose of the moral virtues is that through them we may observe the mean in the passions within us, and in things outside us. Now it is impossible that the moderation of passions or of external things be the ultimate end of man's life, since both passions and external things can be directed to something less. Therefore, it is not possible that the practice of moral virtue be man's final happiness. Further, since man is man through having reason, his proper good, which is happiness, must needs be in accordance with that which is proper to reason. Now that which reason has in itself is more proper to reason than what it affects in something else. Seeing then that the good of moral virtue is something affected by reason in something other than itself, it cannot be man's greatest good, which is happiness. Rather must it be a good that is in reason itself. Moreover, we have already proved that the last end of all is to become like God. Therefore, that in which man chiefly becomes like God is his happiness. Now this is not in regard to moral actions, since such like actions cannot be ascribed to God, except metaphorically, for it is not becoming to God to have passions, or the like, with which moral virtue is concerned. Therefore, man's ultimate happiness, which is his last end, does this not consist in moral actions? Furthermore, happiness is man's proper good. Therefore, that good, which of all goods is most proper to man in comparison with other animals, is the one in which we must seek his ultimate happiness. Now this is not the practice of moral virtue, for animals share somewhat either in liberality or in fortitude, whereas no animal has a share in intellectual action. Therefore, man's ultimate happiness does not consist in moral actions. Chapter 35. That ultimate happiness does not consist in the act of prudence. It is also evident from the foregoing that neither does man's happiness consist in the act of prudence, for acts of prudence are solely about matters of moral virtue. But human happiness does not consist in the practice of moral virtue. Therefore, does it consist in the practice of prudence? Again, man's ultimate happiness consists in man's most excellent operation. Now, man's most excellent operation in respect of what is proper to man is in relation to most perfect objects. But the act of prudence is not concerned with the most perfect objects of intellect or reason, since it is not about necessary things, but about contingent practical matters. Therefore, its act is not man's ultimate happiness. Besides, that which is directed to another as its end is not man's ultimate happiness. Now the act of prudence is directed to another as its end both because all practical knowledge, under which prudence is comprised, is directed to operation, and because prudence gives man a good disposition as regards things directed to the end. as may be gathered from Aristotle. Therefore, man's ultimate happiness is not in the practice of prudence. Furthermore, irrational animals have no share of happiness, as Aristotle proves. Yet some of them have a certain share of prudence, as may be gathered from the same authority. Therefore, happiness does not consist in an act of prudence. Chapter 36. That happiness does not consist in the practice of art. It is also evident that it cannot consist in the practice of art, for even the knowledge of art is practical, and so is directed to an end, and is not the ultimate end. Besides, the end of the practice of art is the thing produced by art, and such a thing cannot be the ultimate end of human life, since rather is it we who are the end of those products, for they are all made for man's use. Therefore, final happiness cannot consist in the practice of art. Chapter 37. That man's ultimate happiness consists in contemplating God. Accordingly, if man's ultimate happiness consists not in external things, which are called goods of chance, nor in goods of the body, nor in goods of the soul, as regards the sensitive faculty, nor as regards the intellective faculty, in the practice of moral virtue, nor as regards intellectual virtue in those which are concerned about action, namely art and prudence, it remains for us to conclude that man's ultimate happiness consists in the contemplation of the truth. For this operation alone is proper to man, and none of the other animals communicates with him therein. Again, this is not directed to anything further as its end, since the contemplation of the truth is sought for its own sake. Again, by this operation man is united to things above him, by becoming like them because of all human actions. This alone is both in God and in separate substances. Also, by this operation man comes into contact with those higher beings, through knowing them in any way whatever. Besides, man is more self-sufficing for this operation, seeing that he stands in little need of the help of external things in order to perform it. Further, all other human operations seem to be directed to this as their end, because perfect contemplation requires that the body should be disencumbered, and to this effect are directed all the products of art that are necessary for life. Moreover, it requires freedom from the disturbance caused by the passions, which is achieved by means of the moral virtues and prudence, and freedom from external disturbance, to which all the regulations of the civil life are directed. So that, if we consider the matter rightly, we shall see that all human occupations are brought into the service of those who contemplate the truth. Now, it is not possible that man's ultimate happiness consist in contemplation based on the understanding of first principles, for this is most imperfect, as being universal and containing potential knowledge of things. Moreover, it is the beginning and not the end of human study, and comes to us from nature, and not through the study of the truth. Nor does it consist in contemplation based on the sciences that have the lowest things for their object, since happiness must consist in an operation of the intellect in relation to the highest objects of intelligence. It follows then that man's ultimate happiness consists in wisdom, based on the consideration of divine things. It is therefore evident by way of induction that man's ultimate happiness consists solely in the contemplation of God, which conclusion was proved above by arguments.